On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Everything is black. And I see, when I go out, I see a lot of people with blood. You know, I just went to the toilet, and then like after 5 minutes, I hear an explosion, and all the ceilings is going down. And then I just go under the sink, and then the second explosion, I feel like it's the end of the world.
A survivor of today's terrorist attacks in Brussels. Three explosions at the Belgian capital's main airport and in its subway left dozens of people dead. ISIS has claimed responsibility. The attacks came 4 days after the capture of Salah Abdeslam near Brussels. Abdeslam is the only survivor of the 10 men said to be behind the Paris terror attacks back in November. ISIS also took credit for those. He was from Belgium and he was radicalized there. That tiny country has a population of just 11 million people, but in the EU, it has the highest number per capita of foreign fighters in Iraq and Syria, more than 500 in the latest count. So why Belgium? Matthew Levitt is here to talk about that. He's a fellow at the Washington Institute and director of its Stein Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you were just in Brussels last week, I understand, meeting with officials there on this very issue. Why Belgium? Who did you meet with and what did you discuss?
I was there for the week. I had an opportunity to meet with their intelligence services and their federal police and local police in critical areas like Molenbeek, the neighborhood of Brussels that has been linked to just about every terrorist plot in and across Belgium. And it was eye-opening. They are fully aware of the scope of the threat, and they have been taking steps to increase their capacity over the past few years and most seriously in the past 18 months, and then it really a tremendous focus since the Paris attacks in November. But they also recognize that they're playing catch-up and that moving a bureaucracy is slow. So they have almost 700 intelligence cases they're looking at on a regular basis relating to terrorism and foreign terrorist fighters, whether they've left Belgium to go abroad, as you mentioned, the highest per capita number of Western foreign fighters, or those who have returned or are radicalizing them to go in the first place. And then now they're coupling that with a second list of about 500 people that they're looking at for serious criminal issues. And they're thinking about combining the list because of the frequency with which they see overlap between the two. Salah Abdeslam, who was captured on Friday, the last living fugitive from the Paris attacks, who was captured in Molenbeek, right around the corner from the house he grew up in. He was known to the local police, but not at all as a terrorist, just as a very low-level street crime personality. They have a long lift ahead of them.
Right. And the mastermind of the Paris attacks, Abdelhamid Abaoud, who was killed, he was also from Molenbeek, and he also had been linked to a failed Belgian plot several months previous to the Paris attacks. So what is it about Molenbeek?
Well, Molenbeek is an immigrant community, primarily Moroccan. It's just 3 or 4 metro stops from downtown, very close to the metro that was blown up today. It is the second poorest municipality in the country. It is the second youngest municipality in the country by demographics. It's about 100,000 people, a high crime rate, low employment rate, and highly transient, 8 to 10,000 people moving in and out a year. So that's, you know, 8 to 10%. Authorities really for a long time haven't worked very hard at integrating people living in that community into wider Belgian society. It's difficult because Belgium is a divided federal country and divided ethnic and linguistic country. So many of those people don't speak either French or Dutch, but among those who speak anything, it's French. And so it's difficult in parts of the country if you don't speak Dutch. And so you can go into parts of the neighborhood, as I did, and it doesn't feel like you're in Brussels just a few blocks away.
Hmm.
Ironically, the Abdeslam home is literally across a typical picturesque cobblestone square from the city hall. There's literally nothing blocking the view from the window of one to the other.
Interesting.
And yet it's a very far distance.
Right. Yet there's a gulf. However, these kinds of situations also exist outside the Paris capital, where there are very homogeneous enclaves of immigrants, mainly from North Africa, who aren't very well integrated into mainstream Paris society. And yet you don't see this level of jihadi activity.
Well, you're seeing almost this level of jihadi activity. It's worth noting that when Europol, the European police agency, has issued its last few reports, the only country that it highlights by name for being particularly at risk is France. And just another plot was thwarted last week. There's obviously very close ties, geographic, linguistic, open border between France and Belgium. We've had French citizens carry out attacks in Belgium. We've had the Paris attacks plotted from Belgium. But I think that the point here is that we have communities like these in hot spots across Europe, and the consequences are not just local to the community or the city or the country, but they're European Union-wide. And I met with the European Union counterterrorism coordinator's office in Brussels last week. They showed me the latest report they had written for the European Council, and it included some pretty stark, blunt language about the need for EU member states to do a lot more to share information, share intelligence, share border crossing information. I'll give you just one example. We know that there are approximately 5,000 Europeans who have gone to fight in Syria and Iraq, and more recently, by the way, in Libya for the Islamic State. But the reports that European member state governments have provided to the European Union only total about half of that. What's worse still is that over 90% of the reports that have come in, and those reports are about only at about 50% of what we know to be the truth, but over 90% of those that have come in are from only five member states. So there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done at an inter-EU level to bridge some of these gaps, because we cannot simply assume that if you're a Frenchman, you'll be attacking in France or vice versa, Belgium, Germany, etc.
And how does the refugee situation factor into this?
The refugee situation is really an aside that factors into this only in that one of the ways that a small number of operatives have been able to get back into Europe is by hiding in plain sight, if you will, within migrant populations with false documents. And we should note that by no means have all the foreign terrorist fighters who've returned come back this way. It's just one way, a very difficult way, by the way, a risky way, by the way. But if you really want to add layers of operational security to your travel, it is one way. On the flip side, the mastermind of the Paris attacks from Molenbeek, Brussels, as you mentioned, he bragged in the Islamic State's English language online magazine, De Beek, about last January, about how easily he traveled in and out of Europe, and they were on his tail, but he still managed to move, and he was coordinating some parts of different plots from different parts of Europe, including Greece.
I remember after those attacks, the authorities in Belgium were promising to, quote-unquote, clean up Molenbeek and to do big sweeps. Did that happen?
There's a lot of things that have been put in place, including something called Plan Molenbeek. I happen to be able to catch municipal authorities right after they get together for their kind of weekly security meeting and have the opportunity to meet with the mayor and the kind of larger area and the local area police chiefs, as well as with members of the counterterrorism, counter-radicalization cell, and the civilian counter-radicalization municipal workers. They're really impressive people. They understand the problem. They're tremendously understaffed. The civilian side from the counter-radicalization was three or four people. The police side from the counter-radicalization cell for a municipality of 100,000 people was eight, and that was increased only recently after the Paris attacks. The police force overall is down 185 police officers. After the Paris attacks, they got an infusion of 50, so they're now down 135. And I asked the police officers if these people, we were having a conversation about the utility of community policing and integrating people into larger society, not so much to prevent the people who are already radicalized and are operational plotting attacks, but from the next person from being radicalized. He said, we'd love to do that. Some of these people may be able to do that part-time, but we just don't have enough people to be able to do real community policing all the time. Well, Molenbeek needs that yesterday, and then what they need for tomorrow is a 20-year plan to turn that neighborhood around, a beautiful neighborhood. The problem is not that it is immigrants. The problem is that the immigrants are not made part of society. They don't speak the language. They may not send their children to school. And there's a tremendous amount of displacement lack of belonging. They have no investment in society. They have no future prospects. The vast majority of people who end up being operatives for the Islamic State are not drawn to it in the first instance by radical ideology, but rather by the fact that they have no prospects and they have no family. They come from broken homes with criminal backgrounds. And here's a group that embraces them. You're part of us. We're part of you. Empowers them and then puts them on a mission, gives them purpose. How would you like to get in on the ground floor and reestablish the caliphate just like the followers of the Prophet Muhammad back in the day and do something important in the name of God? Well, if you're someone that is lacking direction and purpose in life, this is something that gives you that in spades.
So it's not something that is rooted in religion. And in fact, I remember an interview with the sister of Abdel Hamid Abaoud saying that he never really attended services. He wasn't particularly religious. That is just the structure of the groups that promise some kind of cohesion in the name of religion that is attractive to these young men.
That is the majority of the cases in Molenbeek. I'm sure there are other cases where people are drawn to the radical ideology in the first instance. You're talking about a neighborhood that has 40-something mosques, and almost, if not all of them, are storefront mosques, you know, very small, not a formal mosque with a minaret. But as one official put it to me, look, the reality is there is a ideological problem here, too, as they put it. Salafism, kind of hardline Islamic ideology, is mainstream in Belgium. That's not the same as Salafi jihadism, where people are wanting to carry out attacks, but there can be a slippery slope between the two. And as they put it to me, and this is exactly right, not every Salafist by any means is a terrorist, but every one of the terrorists we're looking at is a Salafist.
Matthew Levitt, fellow at the Washington Institute and director of its Stein Program on Counterterrorism and Intelligence, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Take care.
President Obama spoke about the attacks in Brussels while in Cuba today. After condemning the attacks and urging international unity, he turned to the relationship between the United States and Cuba.
In a world that remade itself time and again, one constant was the conflict between the United States and Cuba. I have come here to bury the last remnant of the Cold War in the Americas.
The Cold War, when nuclear war was the greatest existential threat to the United States. President Obama's visit to Cuba marks the end of an era, but today's attacks in Brussels remind us we are in a different one. We look at the Cold War now as an ancient artifact, and yet it represented a very real existential threat to most Americans. Can we compare it to the threat of terrorism we face today? Yohei Drizin is here now to talk about that. He's managing editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine. Hi, Yohei.
Hi, Melan.
So Russia, and by extension Cuba, was the biggest existential threat to the U.S. for many decades. And some security experts still see Russia as an existential threat, most notably the Defense Secretary, Ashton Carter, and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Joseph Dunford. So is this really in the past?
I think what's in the past is the frame of the Cold War. And in a weird way, the Russia of today is arguably more dangerous than the Russia of the Cold War. You know, the Russia of the Cold War, we think back, it had nuclear weapons, so to that extent, and it's a big one, that was a threat to all life on the planet. But there was sort of a de facto black and white, and we didn't cross too much into their sphere and they didn't cross too much into ours. There were sort of rules of the road that both sides largely knew about and stuck to. The Russia of Vladimir Putin is very different. He's not aiming nuclear warheads at us or at Europe. He's not threatening nuclear war or nuclear annihilation. But the rules of the road, the attempt to try to figure out what he's thinking or what he might do at any given moment, is much tougher. We know that he doesn't respect borders. We know that he doesn't particularly respect or fear this president or this White House or this United States at this moment in time. But beyond that, he catches us off guard again and again. The U.S. didn't think he would intervene in Syria when he did. The U.S. didn't think or know in advance he'd be pulling out when he did. And the U.S. didn't really know what he would do while he was there. And so again and again, the leader of one of the most powerful planets on Earth has Washington behind him, not in front of him, where Washington is trying to understand what he's done after he's done it and unable to predict it before he does.
And still nuclear armed. And so is that one of the reasons why Ashton Carter and Joseph Dunford think that he and Russia are an existential threat to the United States?
Yes, yes, definitely. I mean, there's the idea of a nuclear exchange is so terrifying, it's hard to even articulate the words. But the other reason why they talk about it as such an enormous threat is when the Pentagon war games, when they try to war game, what would happen, let's say, if Vladimir Putin, instead of invading Ukraine, which, frankly, America doesn't care about, it isn't part of NATO, there's no vital American interest there, but let's assume that instead of invading Ukraine, he did a full-on invasion of Estonia, which is a member of NATO, or of the Czech Republic, also a member of NATO. What would the U.S. do? And in virtually every war game that the Pentagon has run, the U.S. loses. By the time Washington has enough troops there, enough tanks there, enough planes there to try to push back the Russian advance, Russia has already conquered that country and is continuing to move, and there are massive American casualties along the way. So even if we don't talk about nuclear annihilation, I mean, if that's like a 20 on a scale of 1 to 10, there are other ways in which Russia could theoretically beat the U.S. militarily with tremendous U.S. casualties.
Hmm. And yet we Americans don't really sense that same kind of threat that we did during the Cold War. I mean, there are no duck and cover drills, for example, in classrooms. And on the other hand, I think, you know, just viscerally, Americans feel that they are more under threat by Islamic terrorists. And but what's the reality?
I think the reality is that the fear of the latter doesn't remotely come close to the reality of the former. You know, ISIS does not pose the kind of threat, not even in the same universe, as the kind of threat of what Russia could pose, what China could pose, what North Korea could pose, where you'd be talking in theory about these countries being able to wipe an American city off the map. ISIS can't do it. They can shoot up a train station. They can blow up innocent people at an airport. They can attack people cowardly at a cafe or at a concert hall. They can kill the innocent who don't have a chance to defend themselves. And without minimizing the scope of the tragedy, you're talking 200 people in the horror in Paris, 30 people in the horror of Brussels. You're not talking about a million or 2 million or 20 million. But what's interesting to me is when President Obama talks about ISIS, he's trying to walk this very narrow line. On the one hand, he's trying to say to the American public, ISIS is a threat, but they're not existential. They're not 10 feet tall. They're not going to wipe us off the face of the planet. But by saying that over and over and over again, he's not acknowledging or figuring out quite how to talk to the real fear that you referenced, which is a lot of people, even if it's not entirely rational, look at the videos coming out of the Middle East of Americans being beheaded, look at the video footage from Paris or now from Brussels, and think, my God, these people are on the march everywhere. They're coming to Washington or to New York or to Chicago, and there's no safety from them. And he's trying to remind people that that's not true, but he's failing.
And he admitted that he has failed that. At least he did in a recent interview in The Atlantic with Jeffrey Goldberg. Why do you think he hasn't done a good job in explaining the actual threat?
I think there are two parts of that. I think part of it is that he is an intellectually brilliant man, and I think part of his presidency that we've all noticed in different ways over the last 8 years is that he is rational and thinks the world should function rationally, and that if he makes a rational argument, rational people will agree with him. So if he says the truthful, rational thing that ISIS isn't an existential threat, then it should be so self-evidently true that the American public will nod their heads and sort of hear what he's saying and move along. And as has been the case for 8 years, that is not true. Much of the public isn't rational in that same way. People worry on an emotional level, not necessarily on a rational one. And I think the second part of it is there's a political dimension that's very tricky, right? If he were to start saying ISIS is a threat to every aspect of our way of life, then the pressure from Congress, from the public, to send massive amounts of American troops to Syria or to Iraq, to really try to obliterate ISIS, even at the risk of an occupation akin to what we have in Afghanistan 15 years later, or in Iraq 13 years later, and the thousands dead and the tens of thousands wounded, that there would be pressure to do that in Syria or Iraq against ISIS, which he desperately does not want to do.
I know this perhaps is a little more abstract, but is there some kind of need on the part of Americans and, in fact, on the part of any country to have an existential threat to create and preserve national unity?
It's a fascinating question, to be honest, one that I haven't really thought about. Thinking out loud, though, for a second, post-9/11 was probably the moment in which the country, at least in my adult lifetime, was the most united. I mean, you had flags and blood drives and politics for a short period disappeared, and there was just enormous American unity, red state, blue state, rural areas that normally hate New York and all things about New York, sending flowers and care packages just to random people in New York. That faded quickly. I think we're at a point now, unfortunately, where we're so divided as a country, and there's so much hate and so much fear between Republicans and Democrats, progressives and conservatives, that there isn't a threat that would unite us, because when the threat comes, one side would say to the other, you caused it. The other would say, you caused it. And we would descend back into the kind of chaos and anger and vitriol we've seen over the last year plus.
Great, as always, talking to you. Thanks, Yohi.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Yohi Driesen, Managing Editor for News at Foreign Policy Magazine. Coming up, California Republicans and Donald Trump, how newly relevant presidential primary in June will affect the fortunes of the other candidates on the ballot from the Senate on down. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW. Find all of KCRW's music, storytelling, cultural, and news podcasts on our iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. California is now relevant in the Republican race for president. 172 delegates are up for grabs in the June 7th Republican primary, and Donald Trump is likely to grab a bunch of them. Well, is that a good or a bad thing for the Republican Party here? The GOP isn't much of a presence in California, so what could a Trump California campaign do for the party and for the Republican candidates running in this year's election? Here to talk about that is Jack Pitney. He's a professor of American politics at Claremont McKenna College. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Well, first of all, how are Republican leaders in California reacting to Donald Trump?
Cautiously. There have been a couple of elected officials who've explicitly endorsed him, but not many. Part of the problem is Republicans recognize that if Trump were on the ballot in November, he would probably trigger a very large Latino turnout, which in turn would be very bad for the Republicans. So in the end, California Republicans would support Trump if he were the nominee, but they probably wish that nominee were someone else.
Okay, well, let's talk about the effect on down-ballot races, in particular the U.S. Senate race. The two leading candidates are Democrats, Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez. But there are Republicans in the race, so what does a Trump candidacy in California do for them?
Well, that's the dynamics of the relationship between the presidential race and the top two primary. Under our current system, the top two vote-getters in June proceed to the general election in November. According to the last poll, the top two candidates were both Democrats, as you mentioned, Kamala Harris and Representative Loretta Sanchez. But if there is an extraordinarily large Republican turnout, that gives hope to the Republican candidates, Tom Del Beccaro or Duff Sundheim, that one of them could end up being in the top two. And that's probably the most specific and concrete outcome of a huge turnout for Donald Trump in the primary. It increases the chances that a Republican will be on the ballot in the Senate race for the fall.
Well, the Republican presidential primary is a closed primary, and the Democratic one is an open one. So when voters go to the polls, they'll get two separate ballots depending on their party affiliation. And so how would that play with the down-ballot candidates?
That's a great question. Nobody is quite sure, particularly on the Republican side. There's a lot of speculation that there are voters who are going to show up very specifically to vote for or against Donald Trump. The question is, are these folks going to pay attention to the down-ballot races, which have not generally gotten a great deal of attention? If they do, that's probably good for the Republican candidates for the Senate. If not, that's very good news for Loretta Sanchez.
Well, speaking of that, if Trump is the nominee in November and it's between Sanchez and Harris, who does better?
That gives a tremendous advantage to Loretta Sanchez for this reason. She would stand to be the first Latino senator from the state of California. Historically, Latino voters have lagged behind other groups in voter turnout, and that's true even if you set aside the issue of citizenship. But Trump is so unpopular, so universally loathed in the Latino community, that his presence on the ballot would probably inspire record high Latino turnout, and that would be very, very good for Loretta Sanchez. And if she combined that level of support with support from Republicans, remember it's a top two election where both candidates would be Democrats in this case, she would probably get a lot more support from Republicans than Kamala Harris would. Put those things together, and suddenly she would be surprisingly competitive in a November election.
Interesting. Now, she's from the Orange County area, and Orange County is usually a conservative stalwart, and there are lots of immigrant groups there, Vietnamese and Latino, that Republicans had been hoping to turn. And so is Donald Trump having an effect on that?
Yes. There are stories in the paper about very, very long-standing hard efforts on the part of Orange County Republicans to try to appeal to Hispanic and Asian voters. After all, Orange County is now a majority-minority county, amazingly diverse, contrary to the stereotype of people outside California. And the Republicans there are smart. They know that in order to survive in the future, they have to extend their base beyond affluent white voters. A Trump candidacy would wreck that effort entirely. It would inspire, number one, a large number of Hispanics to register to vote as Democrats, and they would vote for Democrats. Number two, it's also inspiring non-citizens to become naturalized for the very specific purpose of voting against Donald Trump. And those folks would stay on the voter rolls, and they would be overwhelmingly Democratic in future elections. So Trump's presence on the ballot would be an unmitigated disaster for California Republicans and Republicans in Orange County in particular.
Okay, so let's move to another part of the state, the Central Valley, which also has Republican representation in Congress. And there are a couple of seats up for grabs there. And where do you predict the Trump factor playing? Does it favor Republicans or Democrats?
In the Central Valley, as compared with Orange County, you're probably going to get a somewhat higher percentage of working-class Republicans. That side of the equation might help Trump somewhat, but a couple of these seats, say Jeff Denham's seat, include a large number of Hispanics. And there, too, enormous Hispanic turnout would work to the detriment of Republicans. And the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is already playing on this sentiment, attacking Denham for his position on the deferred action for immigrants, even though Denham himself is a supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. They're trying to link him to Trump, and if that succeeds, he has a very major problem in the fall.
Mm. So what do you predict in the fall, just looking at the lay of the land here in California, in terms of the viability of down ballot races and who is going to prevail in the down ballot races?
Doesn't look good for Republicans. Donald Trump would inspire a large Hispanic turnout. That would be very bad for the party. Even under the best of conditions, Democrats would be heavily favored to win California, and that would be a problem for Republicans down the ballot, especially if Trump were the nominee. But even if the nominee were Cruz, he would not be a big attraction for voters in the fall either. It's just kind of hard to see how 2016 is going to be a good year for Republicans in California.
Jack Pitney, professor of American politics at Claremont McKenna College. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, now we'd like to hear from you. Has the Donald Trump candidacy caused you to mobilize and become more politically active? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESSPLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRWPRESSPLAY. Coming up, why are people coming to America and stealing cactus plants?
There's just a lot of collectors out there that really love, you know, our cacti and cacti in Mexico and South America.
Cactus poachers in the American West and a big sting operation. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Cactus experts say there are about 2,000 different types of cacti living today. Many of them are out here in the deserts of the West. But according to a study published last year in the journal Nature Plants, almost a third of them are considered threatened with extinction. They're threatened by humans taking their habitat and by livestock trampling them. But the biggest reason that so many cacti are disappearing is because so many people like them, particularly the rare cacti. And those people go out and collect them and then sell them. There are laws against it, but they're pretty tough to enforce across hundreds of thousands of square miles of the desert West. Joining me now is Weston Phippen. He's senior associate editor at The Atlantic, and his story for the magazine is called Busting Cactus Smugglers in the American West. Hi there.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So who are the primary culprits when it comes to stealing these plants?
The horticulturists, just like you said. So it's a lot of the people who really love taking care of these plants and trading them and growing them and talking to other people kind of in that circle. And a lot of these people, at least a lot of the tourists that come over here and pluck them out of our state parks and national parks, are like Eastern Europeans and Japanese collectors.
Why Eastern European and Japanese?
I don't know. Your guess is as good as anyone's. They've developed this fascination for cacti, and I guess there's just a lot of collectors out there that really love, you know, our cacti and cacti in Mexico and South America.
And they come all the way over here as tourists and go on these cacti hunting trips?
Yes, this story followed a group of five tourists, and they were from Russia, they were Slovaks, they were from Czech Republic, and they had all met on this website where it's just kind of devoted to fans of cacti, where they come on and share pictures and share their travels and their research and, you know, and the different plants that they're working with. And one of the things that they had done on this website is the site's host, a man named Igor Drab, he had put together kind of like a 21-day tour of the American Southwest. And they planned on stopping in state parks and national parks, you know, in California and Arizona and Texas and Utah. And he kind of recruited anyone that wanted to come along. So he got some people to sign up for it. And they came through here and they stopped and looked at cacti and they stole a few.
But they were being monitored by people whose job it is to protect these plants and to prevent the smuggling. Tell us about this. I guess it was a sting.
It kind of was
a cactus
sting.
That. Yeah.
The way it all began is there is a customs agent based out of the Denver airport, and he's an agricultural specialist, but he also kind of has like a soft spot for cactus. And so he had been checking these different sites, and he saw that this trip was being put together. So he kind of clued off this Fish and Wildlife agent in El Paso, Texas. And from the moment they hit the ground in L.A. last May, it was Memorial Day, there were people watching him.
And so they tracked them, and they followed them to campsites, and then followed them as they went out into the desert to find their cacti?
Yeah. So one of the first places they stopped was this little railroad town in Arizona called Benson. And they stayed at a Campgrounds of America there. And two agents spotted their white Chevy Tahoe that they had rented in Los Angeles. And they follow them out in the middle of nowhere in the desert, kind of on this dirt road. And, you know, they sit and they park and wait for the tourists to get out, and the tourists come out and they start looking around the ground and they start huddling around the ground. And this agent who was pretending to be out undercover and part of her undercover identity involved snakes went up and asked the group's leader, you know, if he'd seen any snakes around. And the guy said, no, I haven't seen any snakes. And then he starts talking to her about cactus and how much they love cactus and how they're, you know, foreigners here to look at cactus. And then an agent picks up their trail in Big Bend National Park, right on the Texas-Mexico border. And he sets up camp kind of in another undercover identity, and he starts chit-chatting with them. And then that night they go to bed, and he and a couple other agents wait till about 2 a.m. when they're all asleep in their tents, and he sneaks over and he puts a GPS tracking device on their Tahoe. So the next day, he watches him get up, get in the car, and drive out. And he's following this tracking device that he's put on there. And he follows him out into the middle of nowhere again. And they get off the road, and they walk out a few hundred yards, and they're kind of circling around. And he's staring at them through a telephoto lens, too, you know, trying to take pictures and see what they're up to so he can build his case. But he loses them in some dirt and some brush, and they hike out. He sees them walk away and drive away, and then he follows their tire tracks and their footprints back to this prickly pear, and he said he could see where one of them had cut off part of this plant. And later that day, he follows them back to the campsite, and he's, you know, surreptitiously taking photos of them. And he watches as kind of the main character in this story, a man named Yevgeny Safronov, sits on the edge of this picnic table and lifts out an orange box of Uncle Ben's rice and stuffs the prickly pear cactus inside of it to try to hide it.
This sounds like an awful lot of effort on the part of the federal officials. Why are they putting so much effort into it?
I guess they got excited and they felt they'd have a really good chance to, you know, to bust these guys when they came over here, because I'm sure in the cactus smuggling world, it's pretty rare that you're kind of clued off even before they land.
Hmm. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Weston Phippen. He's a writer at The Atlantic, and he's writing about cactus smugglers in the American West. What's at stake here, and why is the market so hot for cactus?
Well, you know, you can walk around L.A. or you can walk around anywhere in the Southwest and you can see cactus, and there's a lot of them. But the species that these collectors are really after, you know, they're rare. You and I are not going to see them kind of in our lives unless we sought them out. And those are the ones they want, and they are having a huge impact on reducing their population. And there's a lot of parallels between people who collect cacti and people who collect orchids. There's kind of these funny, weird-looking plants, right, that are also really gorgeous. So when you think of a cactus, it's kind of this green, globular little stump with a bunch of spines. But a lot of these cactus, and more so the uglier species, they tend to have these really, really gorgeous flowers. It's kind of off-putting in comparison to that little green stump, how beautiful some of these flowers can get.
And the saguaro, those big cacti with the arms that you see in Arizona and Mexico, that's the only place they grow in the world. Those are symbolic of a desert west, of an American west, right? Mm-hmm. And are those particularly desirable?
Yeah. So people recognize them for those giant arms that they grow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and a saguaro cactus, it can get about 30 feet tall and it can weigh a few tons. It's nothing small that you can just kind of stoop over, pick up, put in your pocket, and run off with. In Arizona, there is a really large black market for these plants. And saguaros aren't endangered by any means or threatened. They're pretty prevalent within the state. But a saguaro will take 75 years to grow one of those arms that people really want to see, that's so iconic of, you know, of the Southwest. And people just aren't willing to wait that long to grow one in their front yard. So there's another type of black market in the Southwest for people stealing those and then selling them to nurseries. And then kind of the unsuspecting suburbanite goes along to that nursery, buys it, and has just participated in this, you know, local black market that he or she probably had no idea that existed.
When these cactus tourists come from Eastern Europe or Japan and they get their samples and they go back, what do they do with these? I mean, they don't have the same kind of weather. They don't have these deserts. So how do they keep these cacti alive?
A lot of times what happens, or what happened with the guy in the story, Yevgeny Safronov, is he has a greenhouse back in Russia. He's about 60 years old, and he's collected 10,000 different types of cacti. And he said he currently has 2,000. So, I mean, he's been doing this for a long time, and he's probably got an operation where he can control the climate in there and the temperature and the humidity. It takes a lot of tinkering around and trying to fill it out and just kind of years and years of growing these things.
So he got caught at the airport, Yevgeny Safronov, with his cactus samples. What happened to him?
So he checked in two bags, And, you know, obviously agents, different types of agents from different parts of the federal government have been following him for the majority of his 21-day trip. So when he checked the bags, they immediately opened them. They went through them, and they found that he had around 70 plants or different parts of plants. And these would have been, you know, a lot of smaller variety of cacti. And he had hidden them in, you know, in socks and in gloves, and he had put them inside with jalapeno peppers. And, you know, they found that prickly pear that was in the orange Uncle Ben's or ice box. And he had this kind of speedy trial, and he ended up pleading guilty. And so for all that, and for, you know, these four different federal agencies following him for 21 days and all that kind of stuff, he only paid $525.
Wow, that seems a very small price to pay for his obsession. I'm sure he'll be back.
Yeah. You know, I tried to reach out to him before to see if he wanted to comment, and he just never responded. And then after the story came out, he had sent me this email, and the subject line just said, ha, 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 ha. And then he sent me like a screenshot of where you could buy something. It was called a living rock cactus. I think it was eBay or something where you could buy it, and it was going for 14,000 rubles, which was a few hundred dollars. And I'm not sure exactly what the point he was trying to make was. Maybe just that, you know, look at you idiot, you can buy these things online for cheap.
Weston Phippen, Senior Associate Editor at The Atlantic. You can read his story, Busting Cactus Smugglers in the American West, at The Atlantic. Thanks, Weston.
Hey, thank you very much.
Boulders being thrown by waves, ice sheets melting. Famous climate scientist James Hansen has a new report out about global warming. It's pretty stark. We'll talk about that next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Preeminent climate scientist James Hansen has published again, and spoiler alert, it is not good news. Hansen, who was the first scientist to call major attention to climate change back in 1988, has found that the dire consequences of climate change could happen one or two decades sooner than previously thought. We're talking collapsing ice sheets, violent storms, and waves so strong that they could toss boulders onto the shores. Chris Mooney wrote about this in a piece for The Washington Post. It's entitled, "We Had All Better Hope These Scientists Are Wrong About the Planet's Future." And he joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to be with you. Well, it's not just James Hansen. He co-authored this with 17 other colleagues.
Right. And then they extended the list to 19. So what's happening here is something really interesting in climate science, where you have Hansen leading a group of researchers who are now endorsing a scenario that definitely a lot of researchers don't agree with, that is more dire, to be blunt about it, and we can get into the details of it. But it's not accepted consensus, but it's definitely Hansen being out in front.
Okay, so what is he predicting? What is he saying that is so dire?
Sure. What he's saying is that he doesn't see any reason why the melting of Greenland and Antarctica has to be, you know, sort of slow and steady. He's saying he thinks it could be rather fast. And not just that, he's saying that he thinks that that's just the beginning, because he thinks that if you lose a lot of ice from these giant ice sheets, that it will have a sort of feedback effect on the ocean, and it will cause a lot of ocean changes that might even lead to more effects on ice sheets, and then ocean changes will lead to weather changes and on and on.
And he's saying that the sea level rise could go up by several meters, not just the 1 meter that the UN has predicted.
Right, although it's important to emphasize that that's in the study, but just as an assumption, he says, if it goes up this much, what else will happen? And if it goes up a lot fast, then a lot of other things happen in his study. So he's sort of assuming that, but I'm not sure that everyone agrees with that yet. The study is actually more about the idea that if you lose a significant part of Greenland or Antarctica fast, then what happens? And the answer is this cascade of things in his study happens.
And why is that controversial?
Mainly because researchers are saying, well, okay, he can go ahead and he can imagine a loss of a lot of ice fast, and he can imagine, you know, giant amounts of fresh water pouring into the ocean, which was what would happen if you lose a lot of ice from, say, Antarctica. But they're saying, well, I mean, how do we know that it's going to happen at anything like the scale or speed that this study is entertaining? How do we know that's realistic? That's what a lot of the criticism is.
And his response is, I assume, because we've done sophisticated modeling and that's how we know?
His response is, if I could characterize it, he's saying that what he's doing is he's pulling together all the different threads, and that when he pulls them all together, it makes sense the best his way. And so what the threads are is, you know, researchers have known for a long time that there are periods in the Earth's past when you seem like you get a lot of sea level rise, and sometimes potentially you get it fast. And so they're trying to figure out how things happen in the Earth's past and how that could apply to the present. They're also using a climate change model or simulation, and they're adding some new features to that, and they're saying that other people have left out features, and they're saying that if you look at the globe today, there's some areas where there could be hints of the kind of thing they're talking about. So they'll say that, you know, if you look at off the coast of Greenland, the ocean is looking surprisingly cool, even as the planet's warm, and that's the kind of thing that they're pulling together a lot of different strands into a new package, and it's a package that hasn't really been pulled together before. And so the rest of the researchers who are looking at that, they're saying, huh, I'm not really sure. I think they haven't fully decided what to make of it yet. And there's definitely already been some significant criticism, but at the same time, there's been some praise, and this has made it through the peer review process.
And it's James Hansen. It's not just any old climate scientist.
Right, right. No, I mean, and then there's the reputation of James Hansen, which is very important. So this is the scientist who is really famous. People will say he put global warming on the map by testifying before Congress back in 1988 about this topic. And he's been obviously one of the, I would say he's the most famous climate scientist probably, and he's been a leader for a while. More recently, he's left NASA, and, you know, some of the criticism comes in where he's also become, some would say, an activist, where he, you know, has been involved in protests, things like that. So people are trying to weigh that side of it as well.
Okay, so let's look at some of the ramifications if he is in fact accurate and his predictions do come true. What does this mean for coastal cities, let's say coastal cities in our country, Miami, Manhattan, even Los Angeles?
Sure. I mean, if we know that seas are going to rise, and let's just get that clear. I mean, that's the most obvious thing that happens when the climate warms, except the temperature rising. You know, seas rise, you melt ice, you heat up the water, it expands. It's all about the rate. And, you know, over 1,000 years, everyone in climate science pretty much agrees that if you keep the temperatures warm, you'll get a couple meters of sea level rise, because that's what the Earth does when it warms up. But the question is how fast that could happen, and how fast really affects how quickly you can adapt to it. So that's the key thing. You know, a couple of inches every 50 years is not going to be hard to adapt to. So what Hansen is saying, and this is again where people would disagree, is that it could be fast enough that coastal cities might not be able to adapt.
And by fast, what is he putting a year on it?
Well, what he's doing is he's saying that he's imagining how fast the rate of loss from these ice sheets, Greenland and Antarctica, how fast that rate could double. And, you know, if it doubles and then doubles and doubles and doubles, then you start to get something really fast. And he's imagining, could it double in 10 years? Could it double in 20 years? And if you take the 10-year, then you get a lot of sea level rise in this century. That's an assumption that he's making and just saying, let's throw that out there. Let's think about if it's this fast. That there's a lot of uncertainty about whether it will be that fast.
So he's saying that it's possible that in 10 years we could have double the rate of sea level rise?
Right, and then double again and double again, so it becomes exponential. So it becomes a nonlinear process. That's one of the assumptions in the study.
And so what is he saying needs to happen right now in terms of curbing greenhouse gas emissions?
Well, he says that obviously, I mean, you should be cutting greenhouse gas emissions. You should be observing the climate system to determine if some of these predictions could potentially come true. But, I mean, this research and just Hansen's general stance at this point is all about trying to burn less fossil fuels quickly.
So what's going to happen now with this study and with the debate around it?
I mean, I think this is going to feed into, let's back up. We have, you know, a really, 2015 was the hottest year on record. 2016 is looking even hotter right now, at least its first couple months. And researchers are trying to track how much ice we're losing in Greenland, how much, what's happening with Antarctica, and whether these places are something we need to really worry about in this century or whether it's going to be steady. This is going to really feed into that whole moment. And what's going to happen is that other scientists are going to have to do more research. They're going to have to study these places. They're going to have to tune their climate change models and their models of the ice sheets and their models of the ocean. They're going to have to figure out how much they agree. But what this is going to do is I think it's going to spark a really big debate.
Chris Mooney covers climate change and the environment for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks.
Julie Myers is here with the listener feedback. Hello.
Hi. And today it's a somber feedback.
Yeah.
Our listeners were talking about the attacks in Belgium. Today there is an interesting debate going on what photos go too far when depicting things that happen like this. If you have thoughts on depicting terrorism online and in newspapers, go to KCRW's main Facebook page. That's just KCRW Radio. And join in. It's a fascinating conversation playing out there right now.
All right. Thank you for that, Julie Myers. And thank you for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.